For centuries, Babylon had been a thorn in the side of the Assyrian kings. It was a proud and ancient city, and so powerful in its own right that it was exceptionally difficult to keep it in the empire. Various Assyrian kings tried different approaches to this problem. Some simply allowed a native Babylonian to rule the city and its surrounding territories, which kept the Babylonian people happy. But this often led to this Babylonian king declaring independence whenever the central power of Assyria was distracted or deployed elsewhere. Others tried imposing an Assyrian governor. This naturally enraged the Babylonians, who would rise up in rebellions and plots, and quite often toppled the Assyrian governor in favor of some Babylonian noble, who would then immediately declare independence. The third option was to keep the throne of Babylon in the family, crowning a brother or other relative. But this carried the ever-present risk that he would become overly ambitious and use the might of Babylon to seize the whole empire for himself. By 694 BCE, this seemingly insoluble problem had become too much for King Sennacherib. For him, the conflict had become personal. The Babylonians were partially responsible for the death of one of his sons. After crushing his enemies in the north and along the Mediterranean coast, he marched east on a campaign to wreak his vengeance on the city and end the Babylonian problem for good. In 689 BCE, the Assyrians embarked on a 15-month siege of Babylon, and when at last the city was defeated, Sennacherib razed and looted it, and even flooded its streets by bursting its canals and dams. Across the region, there was an outcry. Burning a Judean or Elamite city to the ground was one thing, but to do the same to the cultured, ancient, and holy city of Babylon was too much. Sennacherib responded to this public relations disaster by trying to legitimize his actions. In a bizarre ritual, he hauled the statue of the Babylonian god Marduk back to Nineveh, where the god was put on trial. The statue of Marduk was eventually found guilty of whatever crimes he was accused of, but it's unlikely that this stunt did much to assuage the tide of public opinion. Sennacherib's goal had been to destroy Babylon utterly, and he had succeeded. Its northern provinces were folded into the Assyrian Empire, while the city itself was left in ruins. But the obliteration of Babylon drained something from King Sennacherib. Afterwards, he no longer had any appetite for war, rarely going out on campaigns himself, and appointing generals to lead in his place. Instead of destruction, he dedicated the later years of his reign to building, primarily in the city of Nineveh, which he named his new capital. Nineveh had been an important city in northern Mesopotamia for millennia, but when Sennacherib came to settle there, it was in a sorely neglected state. He renovated its palaces and built new ones, decorating them with carvings of his early victories, like the Siege of Lachish. He constructed beautiful gardens, importing plants from across the empire and beyond. Cotton plants may have been brought from as far away as India. It has been suggested that the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, may in fact have been these gardens in Nineveh, which were designed to represent the empire in miniature form. I, Sennacherib, supplied Nineveh, together with its neighborhood, gardens, vineyards, all kinds of products of the mountains, he wrote. The fruits of all lands I planted, letting out the waters where they did not reach the thirsty field, and reviving its vegetation. By the end of Sennacherib's reign, Nineveh must have shone, a resplendent capital fit for the world's mightiest empire. But now, the problem of succession was looming. Sennacherib had at least 7 sons, but when the crown prince died in battle against the Elamites, he was left to choose a successor from those who remained. Finally, he decided to name the youngest, Esarhaddon, crown prince. Esarhaddon's inscriptions recount what happened next. "A firm determination fell upon my brothers. They forsook the gods and turned to deeds of violence, plotting evil. Evil words and deeds they perpetrated against me. Unholy hostility they planned behind my back." Soon, Prince Esarhaddon was forced to flee Nineveh after threats on his life. But the old king Sennacherib clearly missed the danger that was also growing against his own life. On the 20th day of the 10th month of Tebet, in the year 681 BCE, the snubbed older sons fell upon their father while he prayed in one of Nineveh's temples and killed him. The death of Sennacherib sent shockwaves across the region, though Hebrew sources record it with some glee. Riding the tide of condemnation in Assyria, the crown prince Esarhaddon quickly gathered an army and marched out to meet his treacherous brothers in battle. The brothers' forces deserted en masse, unwilling to fight for the men who had murdered the old king. Esarhaddon marched on Nineveh, facing virtually no resistance, and seized the crown that was his birthright. "I entered into Nineveh," he wrote, "my royal city, joyfully, and took my seat upon the throne of my father in safety." Fresh from this victory, in 680 BCE, Esarhaddon announced the reconstruction of Babylon, taking pains to lay it out just as it had been before his father's rage had destroyed it. "To its former dimensions I restored it and made it mountain high." Esarhaddon also expanded Assyria to its largest extent, invading Egypt and capturing it. But soon the king's health began to fail. Frequent correspondence with physicians and exorcists shows that he cloistered himself away for long periods and suffered a variety of symptoms, including some that might suggest a period of depression. One letter from his chief physician seems to indicate that none of the usual treatments were working. "As to what the king, my lord, wrote to me, I am feeling very sad. How do we act that I have become so depressed? Had it been curable, you would have given away half of your kingdom to have it cured. But what can we do? O king, my lord, it is something that cannot be done." With his health failing, under pressure to decide the succession, and determined not to repeat his father's mistakes, Esarhaddon opted for an optimistic course of action. He would name one of his younger sons, Ashurbanipal, king of Assyria, ruling the whole empire from Nineveh, and his oldest son, Shamash-shum-ukin, would be named king of Babylon, swearing an oath to the Assyrian empire. His hope was that these two brothers would rule over the world's two greatest cities together, uniting them and ushering in a new age of peace and prosperity. It was a beautiful vision. But in fact, Esarhaddon's decision would begin the final chapter of the Assyrian age. In 670 BCE, in the city of Haran in northern Mesopotamia, a woman began speaking in tongues. Again and again she ran through the streets and shouted for all to hear, a resounding and unmistakable message from the gods. A slave girl of Bel Aha-Usur in a suburb of Haran, since the month of Sivan she is enraptured and speaks these prophecies about him. "It is the word of Nusku. I will destroy the name and seed of Sennacherib." Hearing of this prophecy from his network of spies, Esarhaddon ordered a crackdown across the empire. The homes of anyone found to be spreading this conspiracy were burned. Clearly shaken, Esarhaddon became obsessed with omens, and his court astrologers spent much of their time reassuring him. To ward off evil omens, he even undertook a number of times a ritual known as the Substitute King, in which a commoner or some expendable member of the palace staff took the monarch's place for 100 days. This commoner would sleep in the royal bed, wear the crown and royal garbs, and eat the king's food. During the allotted time, the actual king remained hidden, and was even renamed, sometimes given a common title like the farmer. Meanwhile, the substitute absorbed whatever bad luck was headed the king's way, and at the end of the 100 days was put to death. The real monarch then returned to the throne, with the evil having passed him by. However, even this ritual had no effect. While marching to Egypt in 669 BCE to suppress a rebellion in that new and restive province, Esarhaddon's health continued to worsen. His condition became critical as his army passed through the northern territories, and he died at Haran, the very same town where only a couple of years before, the woman had run through the streets in ecstasies, foretelling his doom. Upon his death, his sons Ashurbanipal and Shamash-shum-ukin took up their thrones without any sign of turmoil, and the twin rule that he had planned began. The reign of Ashurbanipal is without a doubt Assyria's golden age. The Assyrian Empire at this time was the largest the world had yet seen, and its capital, Nineveh, was probably the largest city on earth. King Ashurbanipal, meanwhile, is remarkable for the way he springs out of the historical sources as a fully formed character, subject to his own preoccupations and obsessions. For one thing, he was possibly the first literate Assyrian king. Up until this time, literacy wasn't considered a kingly attribute. Kings had servants and scribes to do their reading and writing for them, while they were expected to engage in manlier pursuits like hunting and fighting. But Ashurbanipal, as one of Esarhaddon's younger sons, hadn't always been intended for the throne. As such, he had been preparing for some kind of scholarly position in the temples when Esarhaddon's oldest son had died, and Ashurbanipal's career was rapidly rerouted. When he ascended to the throne, he was evidently proud of his ability to read, which he boasts about at length in his inscriptions. Nabu, the universal scribe, made me a present of his wisdom. I learned the hidden treasure of all scribal knowledge, the signs of heaven and earth. I have studied the heavens with the learned masters of oil divination. I have solved the laborious problems of division and multiplication, which were not clear. I have read the artistic script of Sumer and the dark Akkadian, which is hard to master, taking pleasure in the reading of the stones from before the flood, being angered because I was addled by the beautiful script. Ashurbanipal's collection of clay tablets was unprecedented. It was the first attempt to create a universal library, a place where all the books ever written could be kept. He wrote to cities across the empire, instructing them to send him copies of every written work they had. Eventually, he amassed a collection of over 30,000 clay tablets. The library contained numerous observations of events and omens, texts detailing the behavior of certain men, plants and animals, texts on the movements of the heavenly bodies, dictionaries of Sumerian, Akkadian and other languages, religious texts, rituals, fables, prayers and incantations, comical and satirical texts, and books of the ancient mythology and poetry of Mesopotamia. Most of the traditional Mesopotamian stories and tales known today, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, have only survived because they were included in Ashurbanipal's library. But Ashurbanipal would not have the luxury of escaping into his books. Soon he had to deal with the very real challenges of running an empire. Egypt was in a state of constant rebellion. In 667 BCE, Ashurbanipal marched the Assyrian army down the Nile as far south as Thebes and sacked numerous cities in the usual Assyrian fashion. This campaign crushed the insurgency, but as usual, it only created more resistance in the long run. Rebellions sprang up again the very next year, forcing him to march back to Egypt and stamp them out even harder. Despite his efforts, the Assyrians never succeeded in successfully integrating Egypt into their empire. Meanwhile, on the far side of the region, another people started to chafe at Assyrian rule, the Elamites, in the south of what is now Iran. The Elamites had been instrumental in the fall of Sumerian society more than a millennium before, and since then had built a powerful and wealthy kingdom centered on their capital, Susa. Ashurbanipal's father, Esarhaddon, had taken pains to coexist peacefully with the people of Elam, and even allowed outbursts of violence on their border to go unpunished in the interest of peace. But Elam was now growing in confidence. Having little hope of defeating Assyria on the battlefield, they had settled for a similar tactic to the Egyptians in dealing with their powerful neighbor, supplying and arming rebel groups in Assyria and causing as much trouble for them as they could, without provoking an all-out war. But sometime before 660 BCE, it's thought that the Elamite king Toymon made a secret pact with Ashurbanipal's brother, the king of Babylon, Shamash-shum-ukin. For some time, Shamash-shum-ukin had been dissatisfied with his lot in life. In theory, he ruled over all the lands of Babylonia, but in practice, most of the governors of the southern cities simply ignored him and considered Ashurbanipal their king. What was worse, Ashurbanipal would often dictate orders for him and frequently meddled in the affairs of Babylon. Shamash-shum-ukin's pact with Toymon was simple. He would help the Elamites invade Assyria and topple Ashurbanipal, and in return, he would rule over Babylon as its only king. The Elamites were all too eager to accept. When the season of war came back around, their armies swept down from the mountains in a surprise attack on the Assyrian southern territories. The attack was not as successful as they might have hoped. Ashurbanipal repelled and pursued them, finally defeating Toymon for good at the Ule River, close to Susa. One of Ashurbanipal's inscriptions boasts about this victory, which is also immortalized in a series of palace wall carvings. "Like the onset of a terrible hurricane, I overwhelmed Elam in its entirety. I cut off the head of Toymon, their king, the haughty one who plotted evil. Countless of his warriors I slew. With their corpses I filled the plain about Susa. Their blood I let run down the Ule River. Its water I dyed red like wool." One striking image depicts Ashurbanipal relaxing in his gardens with his queen, surrounded by musicians and servants fanning him, bringing him drinks and food. And all the while, Toymon's severed head hangs in the branches of a nearby tree. It's not clear whether Ashurbanipal suspected his brother's hand in the Elamite surprise attack. Either way, 1 year later, Shamash-shum-ukin revealed his true intentions. He rose his armies in open rebellion against his brother and declared the lands of Babylonia to be independent, with some remnants of the Elamite army joining him. Ashurbanipal was wounded by the betrayal, with inscriptions cursing the faithless brother of mine. And he responded by gathering the full might of his army and marching on Babylon just as his grandfather had done. This latest siege of Babylon went on for 4 years. Conditions quickly descended into horror as people starved and resorted to cannibalism. Famine laid hold upon them. They ate the flesh of their sons and daughters to stay their hunger. They gnawed leather. Finally, the city fell, and the Assyrian soldiers poured over its walls. Shamash-shum-ukin himself appears to have died in a fire. It's possible that when he saw that all was lost, he set fire to his own palace and stayed inside while it burned. 1 year later, in 647 BCE, Ashurbanipal turned his attention to Elam, embarking on a war of extermination designed to wipe it out entirely. One Assyrian carving shows flames rising from Susa's towers and pouring out of its gate. Assyrian soldiers are carrying off all kinds of loot, while others steadily and meticulously demolish every building in the city with picks and hammers. Ashurbanipal was again unsparing in his destruction of the city. The ziggurat of Susa, which was built of enameled bricks, I destroyed. Its pinnacles, which were of shining bronze, I broke down. For a distance of a month of 25 days' journey, I devastated the provinces of Elam. Salt and Sichlu I scattered over them. In a month of days, I ravaged Elam to its farthest border. The noise of people, the tread of cattle and sheep, the glad shouts of rejoicing, I banished from its fields. The Assyrians had once more emerged victorious, their army undefeated, all challenges overcome, and now one of their oldest enemies utterly eradicated. The entire empire was at the height of its confidence. Alongside all the trumpeting inscriptions and relief carvings of these military victories, it was in the final decade of his reign, perhaps around 640 BCE, that King Ashurbanipal commissioned the works of art that stand as perhaps the defining legacy of his entire civilization. These are the lion hunt reliefs of the Northwest Palace in Nineveh. At this time, a breed known as the Asiatic lion roamed freely across the Middle East, North Africa, and perhaps even parts of Europe. They were slightly smaller than their African counterparts, with a much shorter mane and a distinctive fold of skin running down their bellies. The kings of Assyria had hunted lions for centuries, and the lion had come to represent all the dangers of the world that the king would need to triumph over. In the early years of the empire, lions were rounded up from the countryside and brought to the capital. But by the late period, they were bred in captivity. These were hunted in more formalized and controlled performances, in full view of the city's inhabitants. The famed lion hunt reliefs portray one of these spectacles, the king in his chariot armed with spear and bow, the lions in their cages, with a small person or child in a smaller cage above, tasked with opening the cage door, the soldiers penning in the lions with shields and spears, their trained dogs straining on their leashes. These reliefs, currently on display at the British Museum in London, are among the most affecting pieces of ancient art to come down to us from the pre-classical world. The details in the human figures, their fingernails and eyelashes, in the embroidered clothes and decorations of the king's chariot, are all realized to perfection. But while the humans are depicted formally, with little or no emotion on their faces, it's the lions that convey an almost human expressiveness and air of sorrow. It can be tempting as a modern observer to see in that sorrow a distillation of the mood that must have been enveloping the empire in its final years. The Lionhunt reliefs were the last pieces of great art ever created in the Empire of Assyria. There were multiple causes of the Assyrian collapse. One of these we've encountered in the preceding chapters: disrupted weather patterns leading to drought and crop failures. In fact, studies of stalagmite formations in caves in Iraq show that from about 675 BCE, the region was in the grip of another mega-drought. This was not a death blow for the empire, but it's clear that during these decades, the Assyrian state came under pressure from its environment and was suddenly at an economic disadvantage to its rivals. Far more pressing was the simple fact of how hated Assyria had become among its neighbors. The Assyrian Empire was the first true military superpower. Their armed forces were the most powerful in the region, a hammer that smashed all opposition. And this had been a major factor in their success as a society. But it would also become a liability. Their heavy-handed approach made them deeply unpopular, and their subject peoples only remained in the empire out of fear. Whenever they thought they had a chance, they would try to throw out their hated Assyrian rulers. The empire would then come down on these rebels even harder, in a vicious circle. Eventually, they were left with no other option but to do as Ashurbanipal did to Elam, to eradicate their enemies entirely. However, nature abhors a vacuum. Beyond the blackened and smoking lands of Elam, to which Ashurbanipal had laid waste, another power had been waiting for their opportunity to expand. An opportunity that the Assyrians had dropped right into their laps. These people were the Medes. The Medes spoke their own language and lived in the region of northern and western Iran, then known as Media. For centuries, their powerful rivals, the Elamites, had kept their ambitions in check. But suddenly, the Medes were at liberty to expand. They moved in to occupy Elam and gathered what remained of its scattered and angry peoples under its banner. They also brought in several other peoples, including the Gutians, Manaeans, and Kassites. Soon they were a formidable force, all animated by a common cause, a burning hatred for the Assyrian Empire and everything it stood for. All they needed was an opening, and this would come with the death of King Ashurbanipal. For someone whose early life was so meticulously recorded, the final 12 years of Ashurbanipal's reign are a surprising mystery. We don't know how he died, or even how he spent the last decade of his life. Perhaps the king was struck down by physical illness, or, like his father Esarhaddon, perhaps he fell prey to a family predilection for depression and paranoia. One inscription, possibly his final one, seems to represent a kind of lament, a wail of pain for the misfortunes that had befallen him. It stands out among all the boasting and bluster of the Assyrian kings as a true moment of vulnerability. "I have done good to God and man, to the dead and the living. Why is it that disease, heartache, distress and destruction are clinging to me? Enmity in the land, strife in the house, do not depart from my side. Disturbances, evil words, are continually arrayed against me. Distress of soul, distress of body have bowed my form. I spend my days sighing and lamenting in ohs and ahs. On the day of the God of the city, on the days of the feast, I am disturbed. Death is making an end of me, is weighing me down. In anguish and grief I sit, lamenting day and night. Whatever the cause, in 639 BCE, the Assyrian chronicles, which had until then kept detailed records of his life and deeds, suddenly fall silent. For this period, virtually the only sources we have are the Bible and the writings of Herodotus, who compiled his histories 200 years later, and for whom Mesopotamia was a distant and mysterious land. But one thing we know for sure. After the death of Ashurbanipal, chaos reigned in Assyria, and civil war seems once again to have split the empire. From 616 BCE, a series of Babylonian chronicles tell the story of the final collapse of Assyrian society. In a surprise attack in the year 614 BCE, the Mede armies marched down through the foothills of the Zagros Mountains and captured Ashur, former capital and birthplace of the Assyrian nation and the home of its god. The city burned, and its people were put to the sword. This was the first time in centuries that a city in the Assyrian heartlands had been captured and sacked, and a message had now been sent to all its enemies. The empire was weakened, and with enough of a push, perhaps it could even be toppled. One man heard this message loud and clear, a king of Babylon who had big plans for the city he ruled. His name was Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar is a curious character. We don't know anything about his origins, but he refers to himself in his inscriptions as Mar-Lammamana, the son of a nobody. No other Mesopotamian king had ever described himself in this way, and we might guess that in the social upheaval following Ashurbanipal's destruction of the city, men were rising from the ranks of Babylon's common people to rule. When he heard of the Mede victory at Ashur, Nabopolassar must have been overjoyed. He gathered his armies and marched to the burning city as fast as he could to join them. The Babylonian forces arrived too late for the fighting, but on the ruins of Ashur, they formalized their alliance. The Mede king, Syaxares, married his daughter Amytis to the Babylonian prince Nabucodurosur II, who history would remember by his Hebrew name, Nebuchadnezzar. This situation had been the Assyrians' nightmare for centuries, its enemies now united against it in its moment of greatest weakness. For the rest of that year, the joint Mede and Babylonian forces pushed north up the Euphrates. But the Assyrian army was still formidable and made them pay for every inch of land. It wasn't until 612 BCE that the Medes reached the walls of Assyria's capital, Nineveh. We can only imagine how that army must have felt, looking out at that city with its towering ziggurat and glorious palaces. We can see evidence of the fierce battle that unfolded in the archaeological record. Excavations in Nineveh's southeastern Halsey Gate have found the ground there littered with skeletons, lying one on top of another on the cobbled pavement. The bodies of horses also litter this gateway, along with countless iron spearheads and arrows, all of it left exactly as it was on the day the city fell. The destruction was chronicled by Hebrew scholars of the time with understandable delight. One vivid account has survived in the Hebrew Bible in a chapter known as the Book of Nahum. Nahum almost certainly didn't witness these events, but he had a lively imagination. In his lines, we can almost hear the sound and fury of battle as the Medes and Babylonians rampaged through the streets of Nineveh. The shield of his mighty men is made red, the valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. The chariots shall rage in the streets, They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. Woe to the bloody city! It is full of lies and robbery. For Nahum, the destruction of Nineveh was a moral judgment on an empire that had wrought such deep suffering on others. O king of Assyria, thy nobles shall dwell in the dust. Thy people is scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathereth them. There is no healing of thy bruise, thy wound is grievous. All that hear the bruit of thee shall clap the hands over thee, for upon whom hath not thy wickedness passed continually? By the end of that year, the three capitals of Assyria, Ashur, the religious heart, Nineveh, the administrative center, and Nimrud, the military capital, lay in ruins. The Medes made no attempt to occupy them, and instead set about destroying them with the same viciousness that the Assyrians had once visited on the cities of Elam. Although Assyria's king had been killed, one general named Ashur-uballit held out a determined resistance to the invaders, marshalling what remained of the Assyrian army around him. They shut themselves up in the town of Haran, and perhaps some of them would have remembered that this was the town where, a century before, a woman had prophesied doom for the empire of Assyria, and where King Esarhaddon had met his end. In 610 BCE, the Mede armies finally marched on Haran and crushed what remained of the Assyrian resistance. The ruins of Nineveh would have stood for some time as smoking heaps of blackened rubble. Slowly, grasses grew over them, and in summer the wind-blown sands rolled in. The city's walls and houses and the bodies lying in its streets were covered. Birds and wild foxes moved in, and hardy tamarisk trees sprouted along the corridors. The library of King Ashurbanipal was also buried, its clay tablets baked in the fires that had consumed the city. In a twist of fate, the destruction of the city is what ensured that this library would survive, the clay of its many books baked and hardened as though in a kiln. The people who destroyed Nineveh defaced some of the carvings that lined the palace walls. They seem to have struck at the faces of the Assyrian kings and symbols of its vanished power, cracking the soft alabaster. But the lion hunt carvings, the lions with their sorrowful eyes, remained untouched. Hundreds of years later, when Xenophon marched past with his 10,000 Greeks fleeing from the Persian army, the people who lived in this region would not even remember who had built this city. They would say only that they thought it was the Medes, and that for some reason the gods had punished them and turned their cities into ruins. In the 1850s, the Victorian archaeologist Austin Henry Layard visited Nineveh and wrote an account of these desolate remains. From the summit of an artificial eminence, we looked down upon a broad plain separated from us by the river. A line of lofty mounds bounded it to the east, and one of pyramidical form rose high above the rest. Its position rendered its identification easy. This was the pyramid which Xenophon had described, and near which the 10,000 had encamped. The ruins around it were those which the Greek general saw 22 centuries before, and which were even then the remains of an ancient city. Layard was haunted by the beauty of these empty places, where the ruins hardly even bore the marks of human construction. Were the traveller to cross the Euphrates to seek for such ruins in Mesopotamia as he had left behind him in Asia Minor or Syria, his search would be in vain. The graceful column rising above the thick foliage of the myrtle, ilex, and oleander, the gradines of the amphitheatre covering a gentle slope and overlooking the dark blue water of a lake. None of this can be found. All are replaced by the stern, shapeless mound, rising like a hill from the scorched plain. The fragments of pottery and the stupendous mass of brickwork occasionally laid bare by the winter rains. He is now at a loss to give any form to the rude heaps upon which he is gazing. Those of whose works they are the remains have left no visible traces of their civilization or of their arts. Their influence has long since passed away. And like Xenophon 2 millennia before, Layard was struck by the immensity of what these ruins represented. Their silent testimony to the yawning gulf of time that separates their age from ours. Desolation meets desolation. A feeling of awe succeeds to wonder, for there is nothing to relieve the mind, to lead to hope, or to tell of what has gone by. These huge mounds of Assyria made a deeper impression upon me, gave rise to more serious thoughts and more earnest reflection than all the temples of Baalbek and the theatres of Ionia.